Well, Rodrigo, thank you very much indeed for joining us for this podcast. And it's fascinating to talk to you because you've really been at the heart of work that has been going on now to actually put a structure in place to fight match fixing and to tackle the problem that was perhaps identified at the turn of the century, but people were talking about it, but not necessarily doing things. And you've been very much at the heart of doing things. Just looking back at the last 10 or perhaps 20 years even, what's been your thoughts about the way sport and the legal arms around sport have dealt with this problem that's come to light?
First of all, Andrew, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure for me to be here. The first line of thought to go into your question is a reality check we must face, that is in the sense that sports does not face integrity, you know, and the challenges of integrity in sports in the same way, right? So if you go back 10, 20, 15 years, you see how different sports associations, different, you know, sports, let's say, ecosystems have developed more so into recognizing and also taking measures into trying to, let's say, first of all, regulate and prevent, right? And then also tackle this type of phenomenon in sports, right? So we have seen success stories, obviously, in different sports. We have seen situations in which we don't really feel comfortable about the way the sports integrity, let's say, function has been implemented. But I mean, it's normal, right? Because you don't have an international, let's say, independent, authority saying where to go, what's the roadmap, what's the vision. So you have different sports going their own way. And also an interesting situation is that sometimes the scandal has to occur first before, you know, the remedies comes along, even though we know that it has happened before in other sports, right? So it's interesting. I mean, you can see, and you can take it as example, just choose your sport, see the history, see the developments, you know, up to recent months. I also was talking to a colleague, you know, there are a few leading sports worldwide that have originally constituted, you know, integrity units as of now, right? Table tennis, you know, world aquatics, boxing, for example. So this is very recent, right? I mean, you are actually constituting, mandating, you know, expert groups into tackling misconduct in sports. So how do you do it? Where do you go about it? Are you actually learning from lessons that were done in the past or not? And, you know, what is your vision and your program going forward, right? So a lot on the table for sure.
And education is perhaps at the heart of a lot of this. It's not everything, but it's very important, isn't it? You do a lot of work, I know, in terms of your lecturing work, and you've studied hard to understand the problem. But is it important that organizations do work together, that there are partnerships, or do you feel it's the most important thing is that individual sports have a plan, have a strategy for how they're going to cope with the problems in their sport? Because as you said, Rodrigo, not all problems are the same for different sports, are they? They all face different challenges.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, education is a key, not only because of the know-how, right, but also because of your educated decisions, to put it like that, in terms of leadership and governance, right? A word to put integrity, this is one thing I defend a lot, is, you know, that integrity has to sit on the table of top management. You know, it has to be supported and mandated and financed sufficiently for this to be a successful road into protecting sports. So I would say, Andrew, that whenever an association is targeting, right, an initiative, a program, a strategy on integrity, it has to also rely on the fact that it's very difficult to do it alone, right? So you have to, surround yourself by the right organizations, experts, institutions. But at the same time, and this is something that is very important in my view, is that we all have to have a good quota of accountability in the work that is done. And if you're going to bring people on board to join, right, it's not to, you know, take a nice picture and say, okay, we're friends and we're participating. No, what are you doing? What is your value, right? And how can we measure this going forward? Because this is a serious line of work, right? We do have to take into account that we're dealing here with not only the integrity of a sports competition, but many times also, you know, the career of athletes, the career of referees, you know, we are even talking about, we can go and extend to the physical integrity of athletes, of young, you know, athletes, right? So this is a very serious line of work that sometimes transcends the overall, let's say, traditional lines of work of sports associations, which organize competitions, they do marketing, you know, they do technical studies about the sport, which is very nice. But at the end, our job is to protect, right, this product in that same way. You know, we cannot do that, going back to your question, without education, you know, without that capacity building. But the management and the tone from the top has to exist there for the education to have a purpose, right? Because you can have the most skilled individuals in your unit, that if you don't have the mandate and the independence to do it, right, and to target, let's say, a member of your council, or your target a club that is part of your structural, you know, federative, line, then you won't get anywhere, right? So this is very important. Obviously, just a last thought, education is also a culture, you know, it's a binding process. It's a long-term, you know, stability has to be there, because to educate, it's not only to teach about things, it's to make these things look as standard as and as normal as possible in the year to year. You know, many competitions, let's say, are on a yearly basis. Sometimes they are individual events, but the education policy, right, and the leadership behind this has to be sustained, right? So it's about, and I always defend this, right? When you maybe sometimes on the ground in a practical, let's say, exercise, you can hear, let's say, maybe an athlete, right, saying, okay, I've heard this, you know, too many times. Why are we seeing this again? But I always say, put this example, like whenever you take a flight, right, anywhere, you have to put your seatbelt, right? This is a standard. Nobody complains really about that, because it's a way in which you have to protect the integrity of the individuals that participate in a certain event. So to end, you know, I agree with you. Education is key, but education has to be quality, right? It has to be sometimes also innovative to reach now younger, you know, age gaps that see this area as somewhat of science fiction, unless you're hit, you know, in the face with a situation of risk and alert, and then things change for the bad, right?
And do you think that more and more people are now beginning to understand exactly what the nature of the problem is? To take your analogy there about the seatbelt on an aeroplane, people understand when they're told to put a seatbelt on, it's for safety in case anything happens to the aeroplane. But do you think enough people understand about the threat to their sport? It seems to me sometimes people think it's just about catching some criminals, some international criminal gangs who are getting involved in match fixing. But actually, it should be about protecting the integrity of the sport so that people can compete in those sports and rely on those sports to be clean in the future. Is that message getting across, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is to an extent, in the sense of what I said before can be an example of that. When you see, because these are international federations and associations I talked to you about, you know, that are building up these integrity units, integrity, let's say, officers, in the sense of institutionalizing this figure, right, of competition protection, of athlete protection, which is something I defend a lot, right? But then the real challenge is, okay, so we are going to set these structures up, right? So what is the plan ahead? What is the strategy paper that is going to be put on the table? And then how serious, right, is it going to be taken by management? When I say serious, it's not because I always say that integrity is politically a very strong, let's say, matter, because if you're in assembly with a clubs or member associations, and you ask the question, do we want to fight corruption in sports? Everybody will raise the hand, right? I mean, nobody will say no against that. But at the end, when this arrangement and this, let's say, agreement goes ahead, then the problem arises in terms of, do we have resources, you know, do you have a sufficient investment in this practice and so forth. So I think this is the issue, right? Sometimes you see it also in sports, and I also have, let's say, highlighted this several times. You sometimes see, and this is something that I'm not saying it's good or right, but you sometimes see that there are certain misconducts that more or less like pave the way into being more priority based because of something that has occurred that has been very mediatic or very, let's say, controversial, right? So if you have, let's say, a sexual abuse situation in sport that has been a global news that is very traumatic, then all of a sudden it's more of a priority, right, for the sports world to invest on these. You have a lot of safeguarding investment, you know, maybe also on women's sports and so forth, let's say, to put an example. But in the end, and this is something I also documented in a piece I wrote before, the fact that if you go down to the national associations of almost every sport, right, they don't have the capacity to have, let's say, exclusive departments, be dealing with specific misconduct in sports. Yeah. So this is where we reach a line of when we basically are dying of success of saying, okay, we're doing good on the international level, let's reflect that on the national level, and that does not occur because a national association, let's say in America, in Asia, in Africa, don't really have the capacity to have an expert, let's say, on competition manipulation, and then having another expert on safeguarding, another expert on discrimination, another expert, you know, on let's say, on physical integrity, right? So what I defend is the fact that in sports and within the sports ecosystem, you do need, you know, and I'm not saying it's one individual, but this unit of integrity should be sufficiently, you know, skilled in the fact of being able to handle alerts of different type of core misconducts of integrity, right? Everything that affects the sports competitions, you should have a unit that should be sufficiently skilled to be able to handle this. And then wherever you are, you may go more in line of saying, okay, in this country, we have a lot more, I don't know, discrimination, you know, hate type of alerts that are affecting the competitions. In this country, maybe you have a lot of match fixing incidents that are going on, but I also have a little bit of, let's say, you know, physical integrity, harassment, you know, let's say bullying. So you have to try to be able to deal with the fact of saying, we're going to protect the integrity of the sports competition, the integrity of the athlete, the integrity of the product, and we need experts to be able to deal with it, with this in a multidisciplinary fashion, right? If you get this, and Andrew, just to quote on the last line, if you get this done, it will be much more easier for the associations to be able to be funded by the international associations and bodies, because you can now see that it's a very defendable position, because you are taking a lot of very important competencies and responsibilities all in one basket on a competition protection, a sports protection basis.
And it's interesting for me, Rodrigo, you were talking there about sexual harassment cases, bullying cases, things like that. Do you feel that, let's talk a bit about athlete protection, because I know it's something that you're very keen to work with. In one of our previous podcasts, we talked to a footballer, Moses Swebu, and he was telling us about his situation, how he ended up in jail, in prison, when really he'd been approached by people who were seeing his situation, seeing his lack of finance through the COVID pandemic and things like that, and exploiting him. And it felt like almost that kind of exploitation. Some sports were perhaps saying, well, that's okay, it's not as bad as this kind or as that kind or as the other kind. Do you feel that we have to sort of protect players more? Because that must be really difficult in a situation, especially like La Liga, where you have experience, when the public perception is that footballers in particular have a lot of money to play with, they aren't going to be liable to being preyed on by these sort of predators. But that's not always the case, is it? People do look out for them and exploit them. So player protection, what more do we have to do there?
Yeah, it's a good point. And let me just start with a notion about what you have just said, that this field also plays a lot with certain misconceptions, right? Mm-hmm. About first misconception is, you know, that if a country is a leading, very economically sufficient, strong country, maybe with low indexes of corruption, you know, by international guidelines, this does not mean that it does not suffer from sports corruption. We have seen it plenty in some northern, you know, European countries, in North American countries per se, in which you see the disparity of saying, okay, this seems to be a low corruption country, but serious, you know, match manipulation incidents. So I always say that match fixing and corruption does not discriminate between countries and scenarios, you know, in this field. But going into athlete protection, I absolutely defend this. I've talked a lot with colleagues also that are in line with the first line of defense of athletes. in a sense of we have to make a balance, right? In a sense of saying, where is it enough, or where are we in a good place in which the associations and the federations, you know, invest on protecting the athletes, and then where the athletes as well protect themselves and are responsible on, you know, enforcing the guidelines that are made for the competition to be safe. Because at the end, it's also a thin line, Andrew, and this is also very controversial sometimes, when more or less in the line of what you just said as well. Because I also defend the fact of stating that poverty also does not justify corruption, right? I mean, economic difficulty should not justify corruption acts or sports misconduct, right? And we have to find a way in which this first scenario does not really occur, and where athletes are not facing this. But it's also difficult, right? Because when you see, and let's go into Spain for a moment, in professional football, you have a CBA, you have minimum salaries, you have good economic conditions for players and staff in the sport of football. And that said, you still find incidents and cases and police investigations about a competition manipulation, right? And more so going into, let's say, a lower tier matches and competition. So this is a country that is thought to be quite developed, with a very good legal and sporting framework, with a good financial backbone to their competition. And we're still seeing a lot of fires going on, right, in this area. We saw it at the beginning, and we still see it, unfortunately, right? So translate this, place ourselves in the African continent, let's place ourselves in Central America, let's place ourselves in Africa. You know, obviously, these are also countries where probably they have lesser of the structure, of the financial backbone, of the sporting, you know, a professional component of the competitions. And obviously, you have all these alerts, and you have very little lines of defense, right? So it's certainly something that does need, you know, a lot of not only development, but I always go in the line of saying it has to be, you know, a tone from the top, accumulating, you know, with the fact of being able to be resourceful. When I say resourceful, is that you have to have resources to make the things that you need to be done for sports to be protected, right?
And let's personalize it to you, really, Rodrigo, because your experience as a global sports lawyer, when you were involved around La Liga, and what did you learn then most, you think, just looking back on that experience? What are you now able to put into practice in your day-to-day work that you learned from really digging into what the problem was for La Liga?
It's a very good question, and I'm very happy to answer that, because we had a lot of really, really dark days in that era, which made us very strong, right? And I'm going to tell you an anecdote. We in our first year of integrity work in La Liga, I was in charge solely of monitoring the matches of the competition. So from basically Friday to Monday, on site and live during the night, we had to monitor betting patterns, you know, no weekends over a whole season, to really see, you know, sometimes we knew what we were doing, sometimes we didn't really know what we were doing, but we were trying to get somewhere, right? So but the most important thing, Andrew, was that there was a mandate, and there was, a vote of confidence and resources into an initiative to protect Spanish football from integrity misconduct. And this was something that was decided by the management. It was something that was given, you know, it was not only words. So you actually had, you know, we had to deploy to the clubs once a season. First year, it was to the first professional football clubs. Second year, we went to the youth, also teams of the Liga member clubs, and third year we also went to the women football. So this is all also, you know, this is an investment, and this was all, there was never a sign of saying we're not stopping, we want to do more, you know, we go into technology, we go into women's football, we go into different lines of the whole competition. So my main lesson here is that, because, and this is why I also was also very very motivated to jump into the international job in this field, because I know that if there's investment, right, and if there's a solid tone from the top, high management decision of working on this field, you have enormous potential, and you have really very concrete and measurable, you know, deliverables of the work being done and the integrity function being successful. It can be accounted, you can see it, you can feel it, you can touch it, and you can document it. And at the end, Spanish football 10 years ago from what is now, in the sense of awareness, in the sense of professional awareness by the individuals, I'm talking all the individuals, right? Referees, players, officials, clubs, etc. It's a nobody can actually you know, argue any ignorance on this issue at hand. I'm not saying it's perfect, obviously, because this is a process that sometimes, you know, it's also when teams change, administration change, then maybe the work that has been done before has to restart somehow. But in essence, right, if you have sustainability and you have a team and a vision and you hold it for a few years, this is a culture thing. It's like compliance. You see it and you can really, really measure it, document it, review it, and improve it year by year into a very powerful safety net for sports.
And in terms of developing strategies, investment, you've said there, is vital, very important to have investment, but also legal structures. And again, that comes to your area of expertise, that it's important not just to identify a problem, say to different governing bodies, perhaps even governments, here is the problem, this is what you need to do, but then walk away. You've been instrumental, really, in putting legal structures in place. Do you and people like you need more help in doing that? Do you need governmental help in how we legally look at some of these situations that develop?
Sure. Also a very good question. I mean, we can talk all day about legal framework in this field, but I'm going to put you a couple of examples about federations and associations that deal with this. You can have the best education policy, you can have the best, you know, guidelines and you know, code of conducts and ethics codes, but if you don't have the legal framework in place, you won't get that far, right? First of all, we do a lot of work, and I have done a lot of work in you know, making sure and ensuring that the judicial bodies of the associations are in place, that they are operational, that they are actually competent to handle integrity misconduct. This is vital, right? Because at the end, if you have an alert, somebody has to take care of it. If you're doing a preliminary investigation and this goes into a formal proceeding, this has to be elevated to a competent judicial body of sport that deals with this, with members that actually are also aware of this phenomenon, that understand what are integrity threats, that understand, you know, very specific also legal aspects of sports law, you know, standard of proof, you know, how to treat anonymous witnesses, et cetera, right? So you have to have this certain type of skills, and this is a job that sport has to do as well, right? To be able to train, to educate, to clarify any doubts of the members of these judicial bodies, to understand what this matter is, because nobody really, not everybody understands this to a degree that they should, right? Another aspect is obviously the reporting mechanisms, right? I mean, you have, this is part also of a situation that can be introduced into the legal line of work. For example, as well, just to put a third example, Andrew, the powers of prosecution, right? And the powers to get evidence from this type of situations, right? Because not all sports handle this in the same way. There are sports that are more well equipped in having legal provisions, you know, that can make them have evidence on sports misconduct, on investigations, and there are some that have their hands more, let's say, tightened in the sense of saying we cannot do this and that because it's not within our scope, right? So going back to your government and let's say public policy, obviously it's very important to have good relationship with the government, with the judicial system. We have to be also aligned in the sense of saying if sports integrity misconduct is in a position to be, let's say, introduced in the criminal codes, you know, this is good as well, right? It's good because it sends a notion and a message that this is the highest level of misconduct, that it has aggravating consequences for the people behind this. It also puts a lot of pressure, right, for prosecutors and individuals investigating this, because obviously the standard of proof elevates to a higher degree being a criminal, you know, a criminal misconduct. And I would say, yes, as a last point, which I also try to recommend association when they do this, if you're going to go into this type of introduction of legal provision at national level, it's very convenient to try to be able to keep within the sports association sufficient lines of competence and action even if a case is being handled by national, let's say, judicial bodies or police, that this does not mean that the National Sports Association should just suspend everything and let, you know, the ordinary procedure go through. Because at the end, this is a very, sometimes very comfortable situation for the sports association, saying, okay, I threw this to the police. This is something that police needs to do. I did my part and that's it. I'm not into that position. You know, I'm saying, send it to the police, but if your legal framework allows you to continue to investigate, take, I don't know, take measures, take administrative sanctions, take preventive measure, or even go through your official proceeding, if you are allowed to, then do it. Because at the end, you know, one of the supposedly good benefits about sports law is the immediacy, right? That it's not as long as ordinary justice. So this is something that also has to work in favor of sport and in favor of the integrity and the safeguarding of the integrity of the sports, right?
It feels, in many ways, sport over the years, it feels like it's taken on responsibility for things that are society, things that are governmental matters. You know, when we've had hooliganism in sport, in some sports, but also just looking at the way sport takes responsibility and accepts that responsibility for what is basically organized crime. When we're talking about match fixing, it isn't just somebody doing it for a bit of fun, is it? You know, this is largely around big gangs. Is it going to be, is the solution looking ahead? Because right at the start, I asked you to sort of reflect on those first 10 years. In the time we have left, let's look ahead to what you'd like to see in the future. Does sport need more help in dealing with organized crime? Or is it just a matter of fact that it's got to do what is right for sport?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously we are far from being in the best case scenarios in dealing with this. I think it's sports worldwide, right? Because you do see agencies and units of sports integrity that are working well. You see the results. You see, let's say, certain efforts being done. But at the same time, it's obvious that sport is also, you know, not only understaffed, I would say, but under-resourced in the sense of saying, you know, for sports integrity to be really comprehended and tackled worldwide, you need more efforts, right? So maybe a balance in being able to handle, let's say, the integrity work through sport and through police authorities is something that should be reinforced, not only for the big events, you know, and the congresses and the symposiums, but also on the day-to-day work at national level. This is something that is also very debatable, right? To what extent should an international federation go into national associations, dealings, and so forth? But at the end, I defend at least the structure that it's in the best interest of an international federation that their members are in the best position to handle this type of misconduct. This is, for me, an obvious line of thought, which also resists a lot the notion of some that someone may say, okay, but it's not our competition, so we don't care, we don't take care of it. I don't agree with that, right? If you are in the governing body of a sport, you should also be, you know, worried, and you also have to be, to a certain level, you know, responsible for how this sport manifests, you know, in the national level sphere of the respective sport. Because at the end, you are the responsible for giving them the guidelines, you know, the, let's say, the regulatory framework, the development funding, right? So I always tell individuals, you can have a sport with the nicest of stadiums, you know, the beautiful trophies, you know, the spectacular TV ads and so forth. But if this sport is corrupted, then your product is worth very little, right? And the public opinion is going to go against you, because, and this is how you have to treat this type of threat with the utmost importance. And this means, you know, development of your members, because at the end, it's not only what happens in the international events and competitions, it should also be a matter of importance and nurture and caring, the fact that national competitions should be equally protected. And this is how, going back to your question, you know, to be able to count with police, to be able to count with your experts, investigatory experts as well, right, to be able to enhance the prosecution powers of associations, because these are all top management decisions, Andrew. and this is my last line of thought for your question. I always tell the association, right? I mean, it's important. It will be very beneficial to count with all this outside support. But if you don't count with that, you have to be self, competent to deal with a misconduct, and you have to do it, and you can have the potential, and you can, and it's actually doable if you have the right leadership and the right mandate to do so. And I'm absolutely confident about that.
And I think things like the BikeFix project are a good example of how support is there, people are coming together, best practice is there. And does that give you confidence as somebody operating in this area that there clearly is more happening now than there was 15, 20 years ago when this all started for you?
I think it's a very good emotional boost in the sense of saying that we are finding more and more quality experts, third parties that are good willingly coming into this industry for the sake of doing things in the right way. And also, Andrew, something very important is that we're finding also initiatives and an interest of doing very practical, specific support for different sports in the fight against all this negative misconduct. So it's not only, it's not only, let's say, the words, right? And let's say support in the political sense, and very abstract sometimes, but also trying to see, that we have also resources and we have expertise that is also put on the table, put on the market for sports to be better protected. I can say even let's go into the realm of, let's say, online abuse. So you see technology working in favor of identifying this type of misconduct, of being able to track, all this type of hate, right? So this is just to put an example, right? In a sense, we have to go into child safeguarding, sexual abuse, hate, racism, competition manipulation, xenophobia, right? All these matters, there's technology, there's development, there are now top companies, experts, people are getting more and more in this era. Information and intelligence is up and coming every second. So the more sport can nurture into that and grasp a hold of that and embrace that, the better for the sport, obviously, right? I mean, this is not something that can be faced by a sports association alone. It has to be smart enough, right, to be able to surround itself with the right people, the right units, to be able to make a good product in the protection of the competition, again, the athletes and the product itself, right?
Rodrigo, thank you very much for all the work you do in this field, but in particular for joining us today on this podcast. Rodrigo Arias, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been my pleasure.
Lovely.
Thank you, Rodrigo. I hope we covered some ground there that you happy with.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, it's a... I think it's more a policy podcast. No, Diogo.